This Memorial Day, click into cordless power at the Home Depot. Tackle your yard cleanup with the precision and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt expanded cordless string trimmer. Then power through the heavier debris with more than an hour of runtime on the Ryobi 40-volt cordless battery blower. Right now, you can get either one for only $159 each. It's time to click into Memorial Day doing at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
There's no real set for being an astronaut. There's no, we'll do this, this, and then you'll be an astronaut. Each case is different. And so the way I thought about it was, well, what if I can't become an astronaut? What if for whatever reason they won't let me and they keep telling me no? What would I want to do if I couldn't? And so I tried to make decisions based on that. I learned to fly airplanes. I learned to scuba dive. I was doing things that I was interested in that I thought would help me in my application. You don't know if it's going to work out. You could just keep getting told no. And so I think it's important to enjoy the journey because you don't know what the outcome is going to be.
You applied for NASA many times. Overall, how many times did you apply to be an astronaut?
Four times.
And after one of those times, you said, okay, I'm going to start looking at other alternatives. And you went to get a PhD at MIT in robotics. So that right there was a lesson. We got rejected, but you still figure out ways to kind of pursue your dreams, even if it's not the exact outcome you wanted, the process was still happening for you.
Yeah, no control over the outcome, but I certainly had control over whether or not I could keep trying. And as long as I kept trying, I felt like there was still a chance.
So Mike Massimino, did I get this pronunciation right? And I know on our podcast, I started off saying it wrong. So Mike Massimino is the astronaut that fixed the Hubble Space Telescope many years ago. That's why you see all those beautiful images now coming from space. It's all because of this man. He's been up in space a couple of times. Story's incredible. And you're also open to ask questions towards the end of that. So without further ado, I'm going to bring Mike Massimino to the stage. Welcome. Now I pronounce it wrong? We can't pronounce each other's names. So come on up. So first off, I encourage everybody, this is an excellent book, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe by Mike, and came out in paperback. It's coming out all over the world. It's a New York Times bestseller. Great book. Mike, welcome to the show once again.
Thank you, James.
Now, I was telling Mike this earlier, but a lot of times, some of you have listened to my podcast before. A lot of times after my podcast, I immediately forget everything that was discussed. I don't know why. I feel like...
That doesn't sound like a good trait for an interviewer, though.
Well, as long as I don't forget before. But afterwards, I feel like it like flushes from short-term memory, and I'm getting ready for the next podcast. And I know it doesn't have the time to absorb into the long-term memory. But there were several things about our podcast that I want to ask you about that did get into long-term memory. And I've used you as an example so many times, it's ridiculous. But
good or bad?
Good.
There could also be bad stuff that stays in your mind, too. That might be the reason.
No. All good. So I'll just tell this one story, and then we can elaborate on a bunch of stories. But you and we'll elaborate on this further down the road, but you applied for NASA many times. Overall, how many times did you apply to be an astronaut?
Four times.
And after one of those times, I think it was, you said, okay, I'm going to start looking at other alternatives. And you went to get a PhD at MIT in robotics. And specifically, if I remember correctly, robotics as pertains to robots on Mars.
I think you got the wrong guy.
No,
I'm not fine. You're fine. I'm just kidding around.
Then
what it was is I wanted to become I decided after college that if you look at the book, it's got a picture of me as a little kid and then a picture of me as a grown up. Little kid dressed up like an astronaut, and then big kid as a real astronaut. So as a little kid, I wanted to do it, but didn't think it was possible. And it wasn't until I was after college that I decided I wanted to try to pursue it. So I went to MIT at that point. and was studying robotics in space. You know, different ways people can control robots in space. And while I was getting my degrees, when I first applied and got rejected, and then a couple years later, NASA announced they're looking for astronauts again, and I applied a second time and got rejected. Then I graduated from MIT and went to work at the Johnson Space Center and NASA again. So they make these announcements every couple of years, they're looking for astronauts. So I applied a third time. That time I got an interview, and they got to know me real well, and then they rejected me. Actually, I was medically disqualified the third time.
We're going to get to that.
I had a medical issue that I had to overcome and to be even qualified again. And so I did that and applied a fourth time, and then I got picked on the fourth try.
So, but you went back for the PhD during this period.
Oh, yeah. That kind of started off the journey. Yeah. Before I applied, I went back to grad school.
So that right there was a lesson, which is that you have a childhood dream, of course. You're dressed as an astronaut as a child, but you got rejected, but you still figure out ways to kind of pursue your dreams, even if it's not the exact outcome you wanted. The process was still happening for you.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. For those, it was about a 10-year span, I would say. I guess I started thinking about it seriously, if something I want to pursue, maybe 1985, and then I got picked in 96. So that's 11 years, or 86, I went to MIT. But there was that journey began for me probably, I would say, in the summer of 85, after a year after college. And what was interesting about it is I felt like the things I was doing to try to pursue the astronaut dream weren't bad things for me to be doing. I mean, it was getting more education. It was getting experience working in a space program. And it was a great opportunity to go to graduate school, particularly at MIT. And I had really interesting summer positions. And I felt that, you know, all right, it's not the worst. I learned to fly airplanes. I learned to scuba dive. I was doing things that I was interested in that I thought would help me in my application. But at the same point, was in general good things for me to do. And that's it, because you don't know if it's going to work out, right? When you're doing this, you could just keep getting told no. And so I think it's important to enjoy what you're doing as you're going along the way. You got to enjoy the journey because you don't know what the outcome is going to be.
I think that's really important, because I'm sure when you got rejected the first time or the second time, you know, you were probably stressed and anxious about it. You were like, ugh, I'm disappointed, I'm sad. There's two ways to deal with it when you get that kind of level of anxiety or stress or disappointment. One is to give up, because then you've just completely relieved yourself of the responsibility of achieving this goal. And the other is to push forward. There's really only those two choices. And I think in many cases, I don't want to say in most because I don't know, but in many cases, people just give up because it's so hard to be accepted to NASA. You know,
it is. You know, you're trying to, you know, I find this even today. I mean, it's really nothing different about doing that or anything else in life. I think sometimes when you're trying to do something that's a little unusual, or it's just, or something you're not used to, or a whole new area, you're trying to figure it out. How does this all work? And I think frustrating is a good word to use, because I wasn't sure exactly what to do here. Right. I didn't know, you know, and you get told no, and you're like, well, okay, but there's no real set for being an astronaut. There's no, we'll do this, and then you'll be an astronaut. It's each case is different. And so in some ways that's frustrating, but in other ways it's kind of a good thing, I think, because the right answer to try to do something like that is just do what you like doing. And I had to think about the problem, or the path was, the way I thought about it was, well, what if I can't become an astronaut? What if for whatever reason they won't let me and they keep telling me no? What would I want to do if I couldn't? And so I tried to make decisions based on that. This isn't going to, you know, if this doesn't lead to astronaut, do I still want to do it? And as long as the answer is yes, and it could also lead to astronaut, I think that was a good path to take. But doing things just to become an astronaut probably wouldn't have been a good way to go.
Right.
Because so I don't think that works.
It's sort of like you figured out, okay, I can do A, B, C, D, E, F, where F might be, I still might end up an astronaut,
right?
But A, B, C, D, E is all still related to how this childhood dream has grown up, and I could still pursue these things.
Yeah.
And I think so many people, like you mentioned, this could happen in any area of life, but think of like entrepreneurship. There's no set standard rules where somebody has a successful business and, you know, becomes wealthy. Or being a writer, there's no standard set of rules where your book gets published and becomes a bestseller. I think this happens in every area of life. And I think the natural response when you fail several times or get rejected several times is to give up rather than explore other ways to attack the problem.
Yeah. And what you said was you're given that choice between sometimes between giving up or continuing. And for that dream, for a life's dream, and for, this was for me, it really was a little boy dream. As long as the dream was, I had control over that, right? I had control over whether I was going to give up or not.
Right. And so you didn't have control over whether NASA was going to accept
it. I had no control over the outcome, but I certainly had control over whether or not I could keep trying. And as long as I kept trying, I felt like there was still a chance. And when I speak at schools, I say this to kids especially, is that when you're trying to do something, it might seem impossible, but it really isn't. It's just unlikely. You know, the probability might be really low, like very close to zero, but it's not zero. There's a finite, it might be points, it might be one out of a million, 0.000, a lot of zeros and a one, but that's not zero, that's non-zero. And the only way it becomes non-zero is if you give up. Once you give up, it's over. And so the thought of giving up was not really a choice. It was not something I was going to do.
But one of those things that, so you took flying lessons, as you mentioned, you did all these things that you felt would move you, you enjoyed and would potentially move you closer to the outcome you wanted. And one of those things, again, is you pursued a PhD in robotics. And there's one thing you said that I thought was very interesting, which is that you took one class where there were 10 people in the classroom and four of those 10 ended up in outer space.
In the class I was in?
Yeah.
That was actually my lab.
Okay.
If you took, I don't know if you're all in the same class together, but certainly in my small lab, there were three of us, and then there was another guy. The fourth guy, Greg Shamatov, was in another lab, but we were all friends and at school at the same time. So yeah, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, just a bunch of us made it. The other students were international students, so they couldn't become NASA astronauts. They had to go apply to their own country if they wanted to. I don't think they even wanted to. Become astronauts.
But that stuck with me. I mentioned to you before we got up here that I didn't review our older podcast to prepare for this. I just wanted to focus on the things that really stood out for me. Mm-hmm. That one stood out for me because it really is true. You're the average of the five people you spend time with. Like if you had just given up on becoming an astronaut and you were like in some bar, you wouldn't have been able to say, four of the people in this bar are probably going to end up in outer space.
Yeah.
But because you were studying specifically in this, you know, robotics on other planets at MIT, you put yourself in environments where people were likely to have successful outcomes.
Yeah, I believe that's a very good point because I believe in that. I believe that if there's certain things you want to do with your life, you need to surround yourself with people who have that same interest. You need to be part of that community. It helps. To be there, to do it lone ranger is not as easy. But I think, for whatever that means, if you want to become an actor or an actress, probably going to Hollywood might not be a bad idea, or maybe New York City if you want to be a stage person. I don't know too much about, but it seems to me that's the kind of thinking. If you want to go to a place where there's people who have those same interests and there's a synergy involved there. With what happened with my friends at MIT, a lot of them won, and MIT's had a lot of people go on to be astronauts and. I think the most of any private or non-military academy. I think, you know, I think the Naval Academy is number one, and MIT might be number two total. But what happened in the case you were talking about, my lab mates, particularly with two of those guys, when I had failed my qualifying exam at MIT, they helped me study. You know, they would pepper me with questions, and we practiced the exam. We had an oral component to the exam, so two of those guys helped me get through MIT very directly. And then I got to be an astronaut before they did, and I got to write letters for both of those guys. I was a reference.
Were they jealous? They were like, "We helped him on his exam."
They were like, "You got in, now you got to help us get in, get into NASA." So I was very glad to write them and talk them up to help them get selected. And they both got selected, both of these guys, Nick Patrick and Greg Shamatov.
We gloss over the fact that you failed your exams at MIT. You failed.
Yeah, that was another issue. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I failed I go through this qualifying exam to get a PhD there at school, and I failed that pretty miserably. I got a second chance at it though.
So I probably only just a few years afterwards I failed my qualifying exams at Carnegie Mellon.
Congratulations.
And I was.
We have that in common.
And I gave up.
You did?
Yeah, I left.
Ooh, that's not. And look how it turned out for you.
I know.
Maybe it's better to give up. You're the guy.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
I don't know. You just countered everything I've been talking about so far.
But then you continued this idea of you're the average of the five people you spend your time with. You not only went to the school with all the potential future astronauts, you then picked up and moved to the suburb of Houston where all the astronauts lived.
Right. Yeah, that was the other thing is, again, if you, the place to go when I, you know, and I thought about, I didn't really think about this too deeply, but the obvious, to me, there was an obvious answer that if you want to be an astronaut, you should go down to Houston, Texas at the Johnson Space Center. So you don't have to do that, but...
Did you have a job lined up?
Well, I sent out... this is when I was graduating, and so I sent out applications for my last year in grad school, and that one came through.
And so you moved down to Houston.
Yep.
Did you pick on purpose the suburb where you knew most of the astronauts lived?
No, I was looking for a house I could afford. And they were all over the place down there. There's astronauts and all. It's not like there's an astronaut neighborhood. They're scattered all over the place. Yeah. They did back in the old days, though, it was more like that because there wasn't that many neighborhoods down there in when they first built the Space Center. And so some of the older neighborhoods, like there's one neighborhood there that Timber Cove is the name of it. And I think a lot of the original astronauts bought homes there. And the pool, and the community pool that they have, because in Texas there's community pools in each little subdivision neighborhood they have. Is in the shape of a Gemini capsule. Space Girl's got that shape to it, so.
It's a little phallic for a pool.
Well, not the rocket ship. The capsule's kind of pudgy.
All right.
Yeah. More like a Hershey's Kiss.
So you move down there, and then you apply again, and you have this physical problem. And so, I mean, syphilis will normally keep people out of NASA. No, I'm just kidding.
That's maybe why you couldn't become an astronaut.
All right, good.
Now,
good one.
Never mind quitting Carnegie Mellon. Yeah.
So what was the physical issue?
It was my eyesight, and back in those days, this is 21 years ago, and things like LASIK and some of the other procedures we have now to improve vision were not accepted. Now they are, and the requirements for vision have changed. I think all across the board, including military pilot and all that. But back then, they still had the requirements that if you were going to be an astronaut pilot and flying the space shuttle, you needed perfect vision. And if you were looking for the job I was looking for, which is called mission specialist, you didn't need perfect vision, but you still needed to see pretty well without the aid of glasses or contact lenses. And so that was my issue.
And so what was your vision?
I think the requirement at the time was 2150 or 2200. My vision was more like 2350. That makes sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
So that was my vision. It was pretty nearsighted.
And so what you did next, I've never heard of anyone else doing, but you basically managed to improve your vision without any surgery or anything. Like what exactly did you do?
Well, There's one thing I learned that was a theme for us later as an astronaut that I think applied at that time, and that is, it's okay to be upset or disappointed. Give yourself 30 seconds of regret and move on, And so when I was rejected with the vision problem, they did not accept any of those procedures, like you say. And I remember I got that news on a Friday because the interview took the whole week, and then on Friday they give you your exit information on the medical part of it. And they said, you're DQ'd. We can't consider you any longer. Case closed. And over that weekend, I thought about what I could do. And the obvious answer, the only thing that was going to work, was I had to figure out a way to see better. And I spoke to, this is where I think reaching out and asking people is a good idea. And I called my optometrist that had seen me when I was a student up at MIT and asked, I told him what had happened. And he told me about this, that there's some techniques that some optometrists have tried, particularly with little kids, to help them with their eyesight when they're little. So if a small child has eye problems, whether it's problems with the muscle function or focusing or whatever, they can give them exercises to strengthen their eyes. And while they're still growing, sometimes this works. And it helps them from avoiding serious eye problems, I guess, is what they're trying to avoid. But it also helps them with their acuity. And so I looked into this a little bit, and there was a optometrist in Houston that had done this. And I sought her out and met with her and asked her to help me. And she said, well, she had never worked with anyone older than like 10 years old before. But I begged her to help me, and she did. And what it is, it's kind of interesting. Like if you're looking at this book, James, right here in front of you, if you hold something up, your eyes focus right here, and you're able to read that, right? So if your eyes, and now you move this book back, these letters have gotten smaller, but my eyes can focus on that, okay? So now, sooner or later, I won't be able to see it any longer. But what these techniques did was sort of, it was a way to kind of trick your brain almost to focus beyond what it was looking at. Do you follow what I'm saying?
There were these
kind of techniques where you would look at the object and kind of try to look beyond it, and then the letter would come into focus. Hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's too hard for your eyes to see it. So if you look beyond it, it's like trying to focus there, and therefore something closer comes in into focus.
And so was that?
And that worked.
How long did it take before you went from 2350 to below 2200?
Yeah, I did this for about 6 months, and then retook an eye exam and provided that data to NASA. And they said, okay, if we're going to interview again, you have to come in and pass the whole eye exam, is the deal they made with me. So they saw that my vision had improved, but they're like, okay, well, you're going to need to come in and do our exam before we spend the money on you being another interviewee, because being an interviewee was kind of a big expense for the government to go through. So it took about 6 months of that training for me to be able to pick up a couple more lines.
6 months every day?
Yeah, every day.
How many hours a day?
I don't know. Whatever it took. probably close to an hour a day.
And so after the 6 months, was it like your vision was permanently improved, or is it just...
No, it almost was like just a trick that I could... And there are other things I did, like I got the eyeglasses I wore, they gave me reduced power glasses, because as you have a prescription that allows you to see really clearly, it takes the strain, it leaves the ability of your eyes to focus. So they gave me a pair of glasses. I wore glasses that were reduced power, so it forced my eyes to work a little more. So I did that every day, and then I did these exercises. And it wasn't like it wasn't as if I walking around town all of a sudden now I can see better. What it enabled me to do was to see better during the eye exam. I would have to kind of concentrate. You know what I mean? I had to concentrate on it to see it. To see what was going on.
So no one had done this before. You were the first person over 10 years old.
Yeah.
But this was the one thing blocking you from being an astronaut. It wasn't like you could Google a solution back then to see what was out there. You kind of called around. You found the right, thing.
Get help when you get someone who could help you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then you got accepted. What did it, I'm sure.
I didn't care about the eye exam after that. See, because once you're in, then there's things that they can waver. And vision is one of them. So,
if an astronaut, let's say, loses their vision,
a lot of this stuff was at the time of selection, and once you're in, then things can happen and they'll work with you a little bit. So, but I think my eyes stayed within pretty much when I was taking the exam, pretty much stayed within what they needed to pass the exam. Now it doesn't even matter. Now the exam is much different. They've entered the 20th century with that, 21st century, I guess now. It's not a requirement any longer. I think they still have some requirement, but it's not like it was.
So the vision
part of it.
So you get in, and then there's the next hurdle, which is there's lots of astronauts, and only few go to space.
Well, all eventually are going to go. Once you're in, a few of my classmates did not, but the majority of people, once you get in there, you're going to get an opportunity to go to space. But you do have to get through the training program and then some people are going to do some things, some are going to do other things, but still, it's not like it only, we've selected 40 people and only two of you are going to get to go. It's like we've selected all of you and we expect all of you to be able to go. And as it turns out, sometimes that doesn't always work out.
Because eventually they stop different programs and...
Yeah, so what happened for the people in my class didn't... that didn't go is mainly for medical reasons. Something did. So things can come up that can prevent you from going. We had one of my buddies had a serious neck problem that came up and prevented him from continuing. Another one on real bad ended up with a brain tumor and died. So before he had a chance to go. So but I mean, it's, unless it was a medical issue, you're going to probably make it through the training and go.
You know, but speaking of that, like and your friends,
you might not be able to do everything. Like not everyone can spacewalk. Not everybody can do these. That's where it started to get like, oh well, not everybody can do this or that. So there's, you know, what you would end up doing on the site. So getting a chance to go, just about everybody got a chance to go.
There's also a little bit of a psychological component in the sense that probably in terms of probabilities, there is a higher than average probability that someone's going to die while on the job, right?
As an extremely higher probability. Yeah, right. No, it's pretty. You can't get life insurance out. So you can get government life insurance. But you're not going. You're not going to be able to get life. It is pretty much an. It's the most dangerous job.
Yeah.
I think it's even more dangerous than the guys who are out catching a fish on the show, on the Discovery Channel show, the deadliest catch. It's like one. It's on like that sort of. It's a pretty dangerous job.
It's horrible because not only that, people might watch it on TV, like the space shuttle blowing up after. Yeah. So I mean.
Yeah, statistically speaking, you know that. So what we determined with the space shuttle was that at the end of the program, when they recalculate odds of what your chances are, there's a 1 out of 75 chance that you would have total loss. In other words, loss of spacecraft and an entire crew. That was 1 out of 75, which sounds like, okay, the 74 out of 75, you're going to be okay. But 1 out of 75 for like complete destruction is pretty bad odds.
Yeah, because if 20 space shuttles launched, it's probably like a 50% chance.
Well, eventually, we lost two of them. And eventually, if you kept flying the space shuttle, you would end up losing another one. You'd end up losing all of them. You know,
So you have to be kind of a little crazy to want to go into space.
Well, it's got to be meaningful. It's funny, I'll do that. I was having my son now is 22 years old, and I saw him this last week. He lives down in New Orleans, and I was he was telling me he's going to go rock climbing in a couple weekends. And I'm like, where are you rock climbing? Is it you're going to have ropes? Is it? He goes, no, it's just going to be bouldering. I go, is it dangerous? And he's like, well, you know, they put a pad down. They try to spot.
He
like,
didn't say.
Sure okay? Well, what he said.
He didn't say, Dad, you walked in space.
Well, he did. He said. He looks at me and he goes, you put your butt on a rocket ship, and you're telling me to be careful. So. And I'm like, okay, fine. And I would not go bouldering. I wouldn't do that. I don't want to jump out of an airplane either if it's working. If it's on fire, I'll think about it. But other than that, I'm staying inside. But a chance to go on a rocket, I'll go tomorrow. Yeah, I don't know why that is. There are certain things. I was having this conversation. I had similar conversations with a Navy SEAL in our office. I watched one of the Navy SEAL movies. I think it was like Act of Valor, and it shows these guys doing this crazy stuff. And Chris Cassidy is this... friend of mine who's an astronaut who's also a Navy SEAL. And I was like, what's this story? Are you guys out of your mind? Right? Do you like doing that sort of stuff? And he's like, do you like spacewalking? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, that's the way we feel about doing what we're doing. And I had a conversation with a professional football player I met last week at a conference and asked him the same thing. Like, because those guys get hit and beat up, you know, they're targets. And I don't think I could do that. But I could do this. You know, there are certain, we all have things that we're willing to do that we feel okay about. And I feel okay about launching in a rocket ship. For me, that was my childhood dream. I think there's a purpose to that as well. I think what we were doing was important. And I actually think you should feel that passionate about what you're doing, that you're willing to risk a life. Whatever it is that you do, I think you should feel that. I actually feel I would be more upset if I didn't have anything that I was that passionate about. But space is about it. I don't need any other kind of thrills. So.
So two questions. One is if your son came to you now and said, Dad, I'm thinking of volunteering for the first ship to Mars, what do you think?
My advice for him would be make sure they're going to bring you back. I think it would be great. But I think that would be awesome.
We don't know.
If the legitimate people, whatever that first trip to Mars is going to have, I'm sure it's going to be a round trip. So, if he wanted to do that or be an astronaut, I would say, yeah, if he wants to climb his rocks or... he likes the rock climbing thing, and he's done some things I would never do already in his young life. I would say absolutely, yeah.
The second question is for you had the childhood dream, you wanted to go into space, you wanted to be an astronaut. Many people you know, they kind of go on the track, a different track. They go on college, job, you know, doing what they think they're supposed to do. And then they end up unhappy and stuck, but they'd like to find out what their passion is, what they would want to pursue more than anything. Is there any advice you would give if they're not in touch with that childhood dream at this point? How could they get closer to what they might love?
Well, in my case, what happened to me is I had that, I that picture of me dressed up like an astronaut. I was 6 years old, and so probably in 1969, I would say the majority of six-year-old boys and girls who saw the moon walks wanted to grow up to be astronauts, right? That's what everyone wanted to do back then, and then the dreams sort of fade. But for me, I think it was, I thought it was more than that. Those astronauts were my heroes. I thought what they were doing was the most important thing happening at that time and would be the most important thing that would ever happen for another several hundred years. That's the way I felt about it. I felt this is the one thing that people are going to learn about that's happening now, hundreds of years from now, the first time we truly left the planet and stepped on another place. And that was happening at 6 years when I was 6 years old. And then reality kind of set in, sort of, where I thought that was impossible and for me to do it. And I went to college and studied engineering and was working at IBM in Manhattan, you know, kind of one of those jobs you can, at that time, IBM I know has changed, but at that time it was a place you could stay for your whole life, and people got that first job there and stayed there for their whole career and retired and sent their kids to college and did all that while they were working in that type of job at that type of company, which was great. But there was something missing sort of out of that for me. And what I noticed was where was my attention drawn? You know, and it was drawn pretty much in two places and sort of still is. And that was with baseball. I will read about baseball and pay attention to that. And I'll read about what's going on in space. And I just noticed for me, what kind of kicked me back into this, is I went to see the movie The Right Stuff, which came out when I was a senior in college. And it brought back all those dreams I had as a little boy. It was about the original seven astronauts. Then it was Tom Wolfe wrote the book, and I read the book. And I started to learn about what was going on now, at that time in the 80s, which was the space shuttle, and I just got consumed by it again. So I think for me it was being honest with myself about what I really liked, and not worrying about that I couldn't do it, but just saying, what is it that you really love? If you could do anything you want, you know, one was for me it would be a professional baseball player or become an astronaut. And professional baseball player required skills I didn't have. And Ash and I thought maybe I could figure out a way to do that.
But let's even say professional baseball player. Again, the approach you took to being an astronaut didn't rely on you getting into outer space. You tried lots of different avenues of, okay, I'm going to get a PhD in robotics. I'm going to work at the Johnson Command Center. Even with a baseball player, there's lots of ways to approach it without being a baseball player, if that becomes your passion. So there's always more than one way. Like, for instance, you could be a writer about baseball.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You could be a
fan.
You could be an ESPN anchor for fantasy sports.
That's an interesting point, too. I think for me, I wanted to be the person actually doing it. As a secondary occupation, I guess I would want to help people go that, you know, maybe be like a coach for astronauts, I guess, or an engineer that would help them. But yeah, that's an interesting point. I wanted to be the one. I wanted to experience it firsthand. There's a line from Jurassic Park where the guy says there are astronomers and astronauts, you know, and astronomers want to see things from a distance where astronauts want to get. I wanted to be out there. Yeah, and I think I would want to be a player, or you know, I would want to be part of the game. And that's what I felt like as an astronaut. You're actually you're the player. You're the pilot. You're the whatever, you know, host, stand-up comedian, whatever they relate, you're out there doing it. And the tip of the spear, yeah, you're the tip of the spear.
So it's interesting. You got rejected three or four times for NASA. Was it three or four?
Three rejections.
Three rejections. Failed the qualifying exams at MIT.
Yeah.
And then you get into space. You're going to fix the Hubble telescope. And boom, something bad happens.
Yeah, so this is what I think about that. I think that
it's a multi-billion dollar piece of equipment. The last time we're gonna potentially fix this.
Yeah, that makes it worse now. But no, that was
thank you.
But when I say, I'll get to that in a second, maybe, James, if I remember, if you're, or if you remind me. What I was going to say was that I think that those trials you go through to get to where you're going to go, it's not like, oh, now I've got whatever, you know, I know there's a successful group of people here, but it's not like, okay, now I got the job I wanted, so I'm going to relax. Like that, your reward is, guess what? Now you need to earn it. I think you earn things after you get them more. You know, if you do it, I think that's really what you want to do. You know, and say, oh, I got this cush job, now I'm going to sit on my butt and make everyone regret giving me the opportunity. No, you don't want to do that. You're gonna want to keep, want to deserve that, whatever that opportunity is, that trust of your client, or you know, your business success or whatever it is that you have. Now, once you get to where you want to go, then it's, you know, then I think it's that's where the performance really happens. So going through all this trouble to become an astronaut and going over those hurdles to get to that job, that's no time to relax once you got it. That's actually where the work really starts. And I think that having the experience of going through those trials and going over those hurdles, that's what's needed to make you successful once you get the opportunity, because it's not going to stop. Problems aren't going to stop happening. And as an astronaut, you're constantly dealing with things that are going wrong all the time and trying to, you know, how do we figure it out? You know, and like Apollo 13, we were talking about earlier, that movie that a lot of people have seen, maybe I think a lot of people here probably have seen it, that depicts what happened in a real mission. You know, everyone had to keep at it. You couldn't give up. So I think having those qualities and having that experience of, hey, you know, I've been in this situation before. It might not have been in a space flight. Maybe it was taking an exam or was in a business situation or with developing a new program or whatever it is. You've failed before and you've been able to recover to get where you are. That's what's going to happen when you're in the position that you've dreamed about. You're still going to need those same principles, that same fortitude to keep going and be successful.
Right, because you discussed, even when you were rejected from NASA, you discussed how, okay, you give yourself 30 seconds to be disappointed and then you start figuring out what's next. How can you keep moving towards your goal? So you're out there spacewalking, trying to fix the Hubble telescope. What happened?
This Memorial Day, click into cordless power at the Home Depot. Tackle your yard cleanup with the precision and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt expanded cordless string trimmer. Then power through the heavier debris with more than an hour of runtime on the Ryobi 40-volt cordless battery blower. Right now, you can get either one for only $159 each. It's time to click into Memorial Day doing at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
So you're out there spacewalking, trying to fix the Hubble telescope. What happened?
Well, in my case, we were trying to do what ended up being the most complicated. We knew this when we were going, and what we were going to try to do was the most complicated spacewalk ever. And on the Hubble, the way it was designed was to be serviced by astronauts, but it was modular such that you could unhook power and data connectors, which were made to be used with a big glove. So you're working in, it's kind of like working on a car trying to change the oil with boxing gloves, right? You can't really see very well. So everything is designed so you can do this with a gloved hand without seeing very well. So it's like spinning a big connector and pulling it off, which is, you can do with a big glove on your hand, and then unloosening bolts with a power tool, and then grabbing something and pulling it out and putting a replacement in. So like, say we're going to replace that air conditioner unit that's over there. You know, that's set up so it's, we can just a couple things on the outside to unhook, one screwed undo, it all comes out, we put the new one in, tie it down, hook it up, and we're done, right? That's the way the Hubble is designed. If there's something wrong with that air conditioner inside, we're not going to mess with it. We don't take things apart because it's too risky, too complicated. Well, we had an instrument that needed that. It had a power, it didn't have a replacement to replace it with. It was a spectrograph that was able to analyze the atmospheres of far-off planets as one of the things it could do. So it was a great instrument, and it had a power supply failure inside. So we didn't have a replacement. We had to figure out a way to take it apart and replace this power supply. And we developed over 100 new tools, and we practiced for 3 or 4 years to get this thing done. And then the day comes to do this, and I'm outside. The guy who's leading the team, me and my buddy Mike Good, were out there doing it. And the easiest thing we were going to do was get a handrail, which was used to insert the instrument, no longer needed, but was in the way for our repair, to to get that out of the way. We couldn't do the repair with this handrail sticking there. It was held on with four bolts. Three of the four bolts come out, and in the fourth one, I go ahead and strip so it's not coming off. And so I quickly realized what happened, what I did when I saw it. I was horrified that the bolt's not coming out, the handle's not coming off, the power supply's not getting replaced. We're never going to know if there's life other places in the universe, and I'm going to be blamed. So that's how quickly I went through that whole thing. So that's what happened, but we came up with a solution.
How did you solve it?
So what I was doing at this time was, one thing I learned as an astronaut was that in our training that I kept thinking about while I was out there spacewalking that day, was that no matter how bad things are, like no matter how hopeless a situation is, you need to remember that you can make it worse. Right? You know, we think that, you know, oh, this is really bad. Well, just start messing it up a little bit more and see what happens. You know, it's got anything else. All right, let's contain the damage here. And so my first goal was not to make anything worse. I had messed up enough. So I kept that in mind, and I tried to think as best I could, not make things worse, work with the team. And the solution they came up with was to just rip that thing off, just to take that.
That sounds like it's going to make it worse, potentially.
Well, it could. In fact, that's why I think I wouldn't think of it, and a lot of others didn't. It was an engineer in one of the back rooms that thought of this, that maybe I could do that. Because the reason we wouldn't is that when you yank that off, you can make things worse. Because number one is you're going to create debris. This is like breaking metal, right? And there's going to be shards of metal that are going to be thrown somewhere. One of them could be thrown at me, which would be bad because it could puncture my suit. Or it can go into the telescope, which is bad, and render it useless. So that would be making it worse. So what they did was they came up with the scheme that I would tape. We had tape outside. I didn't even know we had tape. They told me to get tape. I'm like, what? We had it stowed like in one of our contingency toolboxes. But I taped the bottom of the handrail and then that contained the debris, was able to yank it off, and then we were able to continue.
But once you yanked it off, how do you put it back on?
We didn't need it back on. See, it was only needed, that handrail was only needed to insert the instrument because that instrument wasn't going anywhere.
Okay.
We had to open it up. So we didn't have to worry about getting that thing back on. It was coming off and it came back. It's back on Earth now. It was, yeah. Which was the original plan, actually. It just came off with a different method than what was it?
So now,
what was planned? Yeah.
So now, more recently, you've been very good at being almost a spokesperson for the space industry. So you have your book, Spaceman. You were just on One Strange Rock on National Geographic with Will Smith, either producing or narrating, or and
he's the host. Will Smith's the host.
Yeah, and the planets on what channels?
Science Channel.
Science Channel. Yep. You can tell how sophisticated I am on my television viewing. And you do a lot of public speaking to corporations about everything you've been through. You're a professor at Columbia. You've been very active all around. So in a weird way, you've created an entire media career. You've been on Neil deGrasse Tyson's various shows and podcasts and so on. So, you know, I guess one question I have is, why not now? You should write your own Neil deGrasse Tyson style book about space. Like, do other stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do it.
All right, so that's idea number one.
Yeah.
Next idea
sounds
is,
like a good idea.
Next idea is you should have a YouTube channel where I do like 5-minute little clips about what it's like to be an astronaut.
That's I did some of that with NASA. We had a YouTube channel that there's a lot of stuff with me on, or, you know, there's, I don't know if it's any good, but there's a lot of stuff with me on it when I was back at, okay, that sounds like a good idea. What else you got? That's two good ones. Maybe that's enough.
That could be enough. The YouTube channel, I think, could be big.
Okay.
You should be your own Neil deGrasse Tyson.
My own Neil deGrasse Tyson. Okay. Yeah. Setting the bar high. I'll give it a shot.
But to be fair, you do host that show, The Planets.
Yeah, I have two shows now that are currently being shown. One is, The One Strange Rock show is on National Geographic Channel. Will Smith is the host, and I'm one of eight astronauts. There's eight of us who are participating in this program, and it's 10 episodes. We just had episode 7 last night. I was featured in that one. It was nice. They showed me around New York City talking about things here in New York, and it's a really well done show. The other one, The Planets and Beyond, I think they've aired maybe half the episodes. They're going to take a break. They're going to air the rest of them starting in July. And that's on the Science Channel. So we get that going. I've been on a Big Bang Theory a few times. That was fun.
Yeah. Playing did myself. Anyone see him on the Big Bang Theory?
I go to Spacial Wallowitz. Right. Yeah. So, but it's been fun. It really is fun. I think it's all, for me, it's related to education and telling a story. And I like the teaching at Columbia. That's my main job. And I also like the work I do. I'm an advisor at the Intrepid Museum. So it's now it's, you know, for me, I was an educator, interestingly enough. Where I landed before I became an astronaut was at Georgia Tech as a professor, an engineering professor at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. And I remember thinking, after getting rejected three times from NASA, that all my education, my experiences led me to a faculty position, a professorship at Georgia Tech, which is a cool school. And I don't know if I was kidding myself, but I think I was truthful when I was thinking this way, that if I would have landed there and NASA kept rejecting me, at least I landed somewhere that I thought was interesting and I could have a nice career and a good life there. And so when NASA made the decision to hire me, in the back of my mind, I thought, well, that's, you know, you had that experience in the university. Eventually, someday, your space flying is going to be over, like it is for everybody eventually. And you're going to have to figure out something to do. And it's going to be, you could stay with NASA, you could go work into industry, or create something else to do. But I thought academics would be the right place for me.
There's also a private industry now. Look at, so where do you see things going? Obviously, there's like three or four companies that are, you know, racing to get to space in various ways. Like, do you think this is going to be moved completely into the private sector? And how fast do you think things will happen?
I think this is the cool part. I think this is really what's exciting about what's happening right now. I think we're at this very critical era time here. I don't know if it's critical or not, but a very interesting time. That we're moving from an area where it was mainly government and people trying to figure out what they could do in space travel, similar to the way it was over 100 years ago with air travel. You know, the airplane was a fairly new invention back then. The military and the government were using it. People were barnstorming and trying to entertain people with airplanes and doing crazy things with them. And then out of that grew a commercial airplane industry where we have an airplane taking off every second somewhere. Probably just here in the New York area. I mean, constantly there's airplanes going places and coming. And I think we're at that moment now. I think we're in that transition from like we were in airplanes when it was military and barnstorming, moving into a commercial industry. I think that there will always be a role for government to do things that businesses might not want to do. But I think that's the way the government should work in ways is kind of pave the way to create opportunities for the citizens, right? And I think that our in our space program, it's not just been the U.S., but we've worked with, you know, we're currently in this with the International Space Station. It's with Russia and the countries of Europe and Japan and Canada and other countries working together. I think there's always going to be roles for governments to do research and to develop things that industry is not quite ready for. But I think what's exciting now is we have some of the greatest entrepreneurs, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, and others, that see space as the place that they want to leave their next mark. And the students I have at Columbia, they're very excited about, as excited as I was as a little kid, they're that excited, my students now that are going into this, that want to work in the space program. It's not just NASA and the big companies anymore. It's also these entrepreneurial companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin that they want to go
and be with. Do you see any of them as kind of like pulling ahead in the race?
I don't really see it. In my opinion, it's not really like a race. Like, I think it was the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union was pretty clear. Who's going to get to the moon first? That was a no-kidding race. You know, there was a lot of firsts back then. I don't see these companies necessarily being competitive with, I mean, they're each of them are trying to get people into space in different ways, but I think each one of them is a bit different about what they're trying to do. I think that it's not going to be one's going to win and the others are going to lose. I think they're all going to be winners. I do. I think because each one of them, there's something different about each one. And each one, from what I can tell, not that I am an expert in what's going on in their business, but it seems to me that their business model for each one is a bit different. So I think they can coexist. It's not like you have to have, you know, one type of airplane or one type of airline. I think many of them can coexist. And I don't know if they're necessarily going to be directly competitive. Maybe they will be in some areas. But I think overall, the success of one of them, or any one of them, if one of them meets with success first, I think that's going to help the others meet with success. I think it's also going to help NASA. I think Elon Musk sending his car into space a few months ago, I think that's great press for NASA. I think it's great press for the other companies, too. It's pretty good for Elon Musk as well. But I think it's good for anyone in the space program. So I don't necessarily think it's going to be like one's going to, only one of you are going to win, the rest are going to die out. I don't think that's the case.
So I want to open up for a few questions, if anyone has. We have time for like two or three questions. Anybody have anything to ask, Mike? Yes? So what are you teaching at Columbia?
What am I teaching at Columbia? So I'm in the mechanical engineering department, and I do a few things there. My teaching load is teaching a course on space flight. It's called Introduction to Human Space Flight, and it's elective for primarily engineering students, but we have students from all over the university that take it. And I also teach a course for first-year students on rocket building. So they get to take that course with me.
So are they like, where are they blowing off their rockets?
Yeah. So launching rockets in New York City is problematic. It's not something people get panicky. Yeah. So we and they're not very large rockets. I mean, the point of the class is more to design, fabricate using 3D printing and laser printing and, you know, calculations. So the launching is not like we're trying to make it to the moon with this one. So they're smaller rocket engines that we use, and so they don't go very high, relatively speaking. But still, people don't like the idea of fire and that kind of thing in New York City. So we go out to a park that helps us out in on the other side of the bridge in upstate New York.
Yeah, like New Jersey.
Little, yeah, so we pick a day. Yeah, it's somewhere out there on the other side of the bridge where they have big open spaces and you know, we're not going to hurt anybody. So we go out there. I don't think we'd hurt anybody here either, but people get nervous. So we don't make anybody nervous. So we do our launch day when the weather turns, when we trust it. Usually we've had a couple cancellations, but we do it because of the weather this year. But we do it out on the other side of the river in upstate New York.
So, yes.
So I'd like to know what your physical experience was in space. Like, how did everything you were going through affect you physically?
So physically, the biggest difference, and this is for when you're floating, when you're on the space station, or in our case, on the shuttle orbiting, you're in zero gravity. So that's the biggest thing. If you're on the moon, there's a little bit of gravity there, like the guys are in. We haven't been to the moon in a very long time, since 1972. We haven't had people there. But it's a different problem, or on Mars. But to travel there in zero gravity, or what we do now, having people in extended time in zero gravity, that causes physical changes and could have consequences if you don't countermeasure those things. So things that happen, one thing that, you know, one of the first things that happens is your fluid in your body, which is put in, you know, kind of kept in place with your circulatory system, but also with gravity, right? Since there's no gravity, the fluid tends to pool higher in your body. So you get a little stuffy, your head's big. I remember my first like hour in space, like, wow, everyone's got a big head. You know, and I was like, I wonder what mine looks like. And, you know, you're all puffy head. So you feel a little bit more congestion as a result of that. The body figures that out after a couple of days and starts to redistribute things where they're supposed to be. So it's interesting what the body can figure out. Your spine elongates when you're in space because your spine is kept in place. So you're an inch and a half taller when you're in space in the spine. And you're in your spacesuit. So you're going to go spacewalk in or sized. So that they're an inch and a half compared to the size you wore, the measurements you had for the pool when you're practicing underwater. When we went, we go to space, they give you an extra inch and a half because they want you crushed inside of this thing. But you lose all that. Although one of my crewmates claimed that if you were that height for one day in your life, that was your height forever.
That's on his driver's license now.
That's what he said he was going to do. So we measured him every day. Like, you know, a little kid, you know, if you have a little kid. Put it there. We had to do it on the ground because you're floating around. We laid him on the ground and we had a little piece of duct tape that we would mark how tall he was. And then we measure it. So he updated his license by an inch and a half or so. But you lose it when you come back. That all settles back in. So you're not that tall only in space. The biggest, there's other things. The biggest change for me, or the thing you notice the most, is this: that your vestibular system, which tells us when we're accelerating, when we're upside down, we're making it. It all works together. Everything, like, we do this, we drive it. We're able to drive a car, fly a plane, ride a bike, all because of our vestibular system. It all works in concert with our eyes, and our eye movements and our head movements. It all is tuned really well to work in one gravity. And when you get to space, that's all floating. And so it's not working together. So your eyes are saying, wait, I'm moving around. And your inner ear is saying, no, you're not. You're perfectly still because it's not getting any input. and it leads to nausea, just like you would get. So you get that sick. So I barfed my first day in space, and most people do.
So when you barf, is it is it coming?
Now we got James interested. Once we got the.
Now I'm curious. Like, is the barf floating around or?
No. See, well, you know, you don't want that to happen. There are certain things you really don't want floating around a spaceship, and barf is one of them. So, and throwing up is part of your training, and not that they make you throw up, but is, you know, think about it. If you were going to space, you know, what would be on your mind? And so, like, I don't want to throw up over everything is really on your mind. So we had barf bags that, emesis bags, which I guess emesis is a fancy word for barf. And, I had those ready to go because I knew this could happen to me. I had one in, I had a side pocket on my spaceship. I had one in my leg, I had a pocket in my leg you could put stuff in. So I had them ready. I think I even had one on my clipboard just in case. And they would fold up, but they were really good emesis bags. They were cloth on the outside. They were all plastic on the inside. They had a shroud on them so you can like bury your face and then it would conform to your face. It had like a little kind of, like a twisty kind of thing. So you could it would form to your face. You could shove your face in it. It would form a good seal. You could put your whole head in there. And then it had a shroud that you could kind of throw over your head, more or less, and barf into this thing, right?
So did everybody get it when you first got into space? Did everybody sort of go to their private little corners and put on this bag?
Depending on the timing, which is not always controllable. You know, sometimes it would just, you know, not that you might have a lot of experience with throwing up. I'm not saying that. But I guess apparently from my experience with it in space, is it doesn't necessarily give you much warning, and you try to fight it. Oh, no, I'm okay, no, I'm okay. Oh, no, I'm not okay. So you really want the thing handy, and sometimes it happens, you know, like you hear it right behind you, and you see the, you know, someone. So usually it's not like, oh, it's time for me to throw up in a minute. You know, it usually happens. You got to be ready for it at a moment's notice. So, yeah.
All right, next question.
That's another thing. The bigger issue, just so about the bigger issues, though, with health, radiation protection, so because you're getting a lot of much more radiation up there, so you need ways to shield from that, and also muscle loss and bone loss from the zero gravity. So on space station, for example, the exercise period is 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, and that's just to maintain a fitness level so you don't get bone and muscle loss. What's that?
Do you stay younger?
I don't see the person asking that question. It's like, do you stay younger? It's like an angel is asking me. Do you stay younger? No, unfortunately, age. I think if you figured it out, like, because you're a little bit further away from the Earth, you know, time occurs like a microsecond differently over a couple of years or something. But no, you don't. It doesn't do any of that for you. You know, you still get older, and you know, you
like there aren't health benefits to not.
You'd have to go. You'd have to go
using the spine as much.
What's that?
There's not health benefits to not putting as much pressure on the spine.
Being in space?
Yeah.
I mean, you actually feel a little bit of pain in your back when it elongates. It feels kind of weird. It gives you some discomfort. But then after that, you're fine. You have to be careful on when you come home, that when it all goes back together like that, that you're not allowed to lift anything heavy or do anything. Because we've had some guys pop a disc, you know, turning, doing something, lifting something. So that's all settling for a few days. And you're not allowed to drive a car or fly an airplane or do anything that takes that sort of hand-eye coordination because your vestibular system was messed up. But if you were able to get like far away from the planet, light years away, go ahead, I think you'll see that time effect. But no fountain of youth. Where again is the, what's going on? What's that?
How about this? What? One of the advantages of being the tip of the spear is you don't have to think about the mission. You're handed the mission and you have to execute it. Now, if you were the one creating the mission, in your mind, what would be the mission you would want to create?
Well, the tip of the spear thing, that's one way you could look at it, that you're handed them. But really, what we felt as astronauts, we were handed the task. But I felt like that the thing that would make you a more effective astronaut was to be involved in what was going on. So the more you could know about what you were doing, the suggestions you could make, You were given the objective of what, hey, we're trying to go from here to there and do this. But then as astronauts, we had the unique opportunity to have that experience. But also, you know, in my case, I was able to contribute with my engineering background. And so I think you're a better tip at the end of the spear if you also understand what's going on and a part of the planning and design and all that. As far as where I think we should go next, maybe that's what you're asking as well, is as I think we should go to the moon next. I think this idea of Mars is kind of cool, but it's a little, right now it's beyond our grasp. Maybe Elon Musk can figure out a way to go there, but we've been talking about going to Mars for a long time. You know, we have bumper stickers and buttons and stuff, and every astronaut thinks they're going to Mars when they get picked. For the past few decades, my buddy Chell Lindgren is a newer astronaut. He was picked in 2009, and he flew a few years ago for the first time. Was visiting here 2 years ago. Spoke up at Columbia, and we were hanging out. And he's like, "We're getting ready to pick this new group of astronauts that they just selected about 6 months ago, maybe almost a year now." But he said that he goes, "Cause can you believe it, Mass? They're saying they're going to send these people to Mars." You know, they told us we were going to Mars back in 2009. You know, they told me I was going to Mars in 1997. And our patch, you get a class patch, you design your patch, and it has the Earth and like a space shuttle and space station, and then the moon, and then Mars. We thought we were going everywhere, you know? And then you realize, nah, it's not going to, 20 years go by, like, what happened, you know? And we're saying it's still going to be 10 to 15 or 20 or whatever, and it's long enough out there where you don't, you know, it's not like we're saying 200 years from now. You know, we keep saying 10, 15, you know, so it's like, oh, okay. But we're also not saying like 2 or 3, because you'd remember that and say, hey, what happened? So like all these years go, like, where are we? When are we going to Mars? 10, 15? So that the answer never changes, and we never seem to be able to get there. I think that it's a little bit too much for us right now. Not that we can't, but resource-wise, it's really expensive to get there, and it takes a long time. And I would think that if we were to do that, it's probably going to be more, you know, get there, do it, come back, and then can we afford to go back and set something up? Whereas the moon, it's been 50 years since we've had people there almost. It's within our grasp. So it's not the easiest place to get to. It's 50 years. It's not like we're going there all the time. And if you look at exploration over the centuries, over 100 years ago, they were doing things like who could be the first to Mount Everest, who was going to be the first to the North Pole or the South Pole, that, you know, just do it. And then they did it. And like, what do we do now? Well, let's go home. And that was what they did. And then 50 years later, they set up, you know, the Antarctic Research Station, and now we have a presence there on a permanent basis. And I think that's just about time to go back to the moon now. And it's within our grasp. I think there's resources there that would make it worthwhile to go. I think for tourism, I think people would like that. And I think also as a research station, this is maybe where the governments could cooperate. I think it'd be cool. Or as a launch pad. I don't have any. I haven't worked out any numbers, but I would think that going there and going to the moon would get us to Mars more quickly as a launch platform, as you say. Plus, there are problems. There are issues with being on a surface of a planet for a longer period of time with reduced gravity. We have a lot of data now of people in zero gravity, but when you're on a planetary surface, you got to deal with rocks and sharp edges and dirt and how to protect from radiation in that way. That you don't, it's different now. We're still even in low Earth orbit. We're somewhat protected by the Earth's magnetic field. You're not going to have that on Mars or on the moon. Cosmic radiation. So I think all those problems would be really well worked out on the moon. Transmission time delay for help. Right now in the space station, it's, you know, it's pretty quick. Yeah, Houston, we have a problem. You get an answer. Same thing from the moon. Maybe 3 seconds. From Mars, you're going to say, Houston, we have a problem. And about a half hour later, they'll say, "Oh, what was that?" You know, you have to. So you got to be really independent there. You know, a day and a half away versus. I think the moon is where we should go. I think it was great that we went there when I was a little boy, but I think now it's to go back and stay, and set something up where we could stay there. So if I was dreaming, that's where I would go. I think we're out of time.
So we're out of time. But one thing I want to mention that I forgot to mention: Mike is also the first person, and he's on the stage right now, the first person to ever tweet from outer space. So what was that tweet?
All right, so the first tweet from space, you know, I asked Neil Armstrong when I met him, when did he come up with the thing that he said on the moon? You know, did he think of it, or did he get a, you know, speech writer? And he goes, you know, Mike, I didn't think about it until after the landing. I'm like, really? He goes, because I figured it this way, if we didn't land on a moon, there'd be no reason to say anything. So he got to the moon, and then he came up with the little thing that he said. And I'll repeat that in a second here. I've got another part of the story. So I thought the same thing. So I got to space. I'm like, all right, I'm going to send this first tweet from space. And I wrote, all right, launch was awesome. We had just launched. Launch was awesome. I'm feeling great, enjoying the view. The adventure of a lifetime has begun. Poof, right? That goes out. All right. At the same time, my kids are both teenagers. My son was 13. My daughter was 15. And think about it. If you have teenagers at home, or all of you at one time were teenagers, if your parent, one of your parents was in space, you'd probably be pretty happy about it. And my kids certainly were. Like, Dad can't bother us. He's in space. So we had email. Not only did we have Twitter, but we had email, right? So I'm sending email down there, you know, to the kids, and you know, hey, and I'm not getting anything, and they're ignoring me, right? And I can see them, they're like, they're not answering my email. I'm not hearing from these kids. Nothing. Okay. Saturday comes, we launch on a Monday. Saturday comes, Saturday Night Live, they make fun of me. Seth Meyers says, he gets on air, and you can probably, if you search, you'll probably find us online. He says something like, we have the first tweet from space. Mike Massimino's first tweet from space. And here it is. Launch was awesome. And he goes on to say, in 40 years, we've gone from one small step for man, one giant leap to mankind, which is what Neil Armstrong came up with, to launch was awesome. If we ever find a life in the universe, I assume this is how we'll be notified. And it shows a little Twitter thing, and it says, geez, dudes, aliens, right? So they make fun of me. I don't know what this is going on. We're trying to do spacewalks. I'm not paying attention to what's going on Saturday Night Live over the weekend. Monday comes. We're going to end on this story, okay? All right. Monday comes, and my kids go to school, right? And see their friends who have watched Saturday Night Live, I assume. And I get email from these kids from my, I'm like, oh, finally. You know, I figure, all right, the spacewalks are over. I did the thing with the handrail, broke it off, and they were the big hero. They're probably saying, Dad, you're the best. You know, you're a great, you really saved the day. Thank you for saving astronomy for the world. I'm expecting to see something like this. Get a little respect around the house. This is what I get. Dad, they made fun of you on Saturday Night Live. All the kids at school loved it. Keep saying stupid stuff.
That's funny.
That's all I got.
Mike, thanks so much. Thanks, yeah.
This Memorial Day, click into cordless power at the Home Depot. Tackle your yard cleanup with the precision and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt expanded cordless string trimmer. Then power through the heavier debris with more than an hour of runtime on the Ryobi 40-volt cordless battery blower. Right now, you can get either one for only $159 each. It's time to click into Memorial Day doing at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.